Good day. Today in our internet conference room is a guest, James McComb. He is from Scotland, and I would ask Jamie to introduce himself, please.
Good morning. My name is James Malcolm, and I've come from Scotland. I live in Edinburgh. And I'm recently, up until recently, I was a commissioner with a mental health watchdog body in Scotland called the Mental Welfare Commission. I've been involved in mental health probably for nearly 40 years now. And it's a great pleasure to be here in
Ekaterinburg. It's not an easy word to pronounce. Welcome to the capital of the Urals region of Russia. And I guess your background, your expertise is the reason why you are in Ekaterinburg. My guess is that you have never been to Russia before.
That's correct. I've never been to Russia before, and I'm delighted to be here. It's fascinating to meet people here and to see what life is like in Russia.
What was your first impression then of Russia?
Well, I arrived at 4 in the morning from on a flight from Frankfurt, and when I was coming in on a taxi, what struck me was how familiar it seemed. I live in Edinburgh, which is a very old, beautiful city, but I was brought up in Glasgow, which is a much more industrial city, and in many ways it seemed quite similar to what I was used to as when I was growing up.
That's interesting comparison. So why are you in Ekaterinburg? What is the purpose of this long trip?
I'm participating in a seminar this coming weekend, and I guess I'm here because of my experience in mental health and the practical application of rights to the care of people who have mental illness, and the seminar is really focusing on particular aspects of ways of protecting people who have mental illness.
That's true that in the Urals regions, at least the NGOs Utezhnik and other NGOs in collaboration with the Ombudsman as well as Kobolist are working on this issue, on the issue of protection of rights of mentally ill people, and so far this is the it's not the first project which is run on the issue of protection of mentally ill people. We have already some interesting cases within the Russian courts and before the European Court of Human Rights, and it would be, I think, for these experts who are working on this issue here in Russia, it will be interesting to learn your experience in Scotland. And as I understand, it's already very rich experience. It's you have this system of protection of rights of mental ill people for many years.
That's correct. The organisation I work for has been around for a long time, for over 100 years, and it's had its protective function since
over 100 years.
Yes, over 100 years. But the protective function of the Mental Welfare Commission really came into effect in 1960 under the mental health legislation then. But what's been most exciting for us, and the thing that has changed and improved the protection, is new legislation that came in 2003 that was passed by the Scottish Parliament. And that introduced a set of principles into mental health legislation which have proved invaluable for the Commission and for the services that provide help to people with mental health problems. It's proved invaluable in providing a framework, a protective rights-based framework for care and treatment.
Mm-hmm. So if you can explain simply how this system works, for example, a friend of mine, my relative, have issues, mental issues, and I think this person can be dangerous for himself or for the family or society. What would they do in Scotland?
The first thing that would happen if you came into contact with mental health services, and that could be through a variety of routes. It could be through your doctor, your general practitioner, the family doctor, referring you to psychiatric services, or if you'd been in some sort of crisis and you'd ended up in hospital. The first thing that would happen would be that you'd be assessed for the care and treatment that you required. Now, if your judgment was impaired to the extent that you couldn't make a reasonable decision about your care and treatment, and if certain other conditions were met, you could be treated compulsorily. You could be treated against your wishes. And that could be as in an emergency situation for about 72 hours. And a decision on that could be made by any doctor. It could be for up to 28 days. It could be extended for up to 28 days. And that decision has to be made by a psychiatrist, a specialist. But compulsory treatment beyond that has to be approved by a tribunal, a mental health tribunal.
Tribunals, in terms of, it's a court.
It's an independent tribunal service. It's not really a court, although it is chaired by a lawyer. In the past, and this is one of the innovations of this new legislation, in the past these decisions were taken place in court, in what in Scotland were called sheriff courts. But the problem with that was that there was a criminal association with those courts, and it gave it kind of reinforced some of the stigma that exists around mental illness, that these decisions were being taken in a purely legal setting, without, were not ideal for making decisions about people's health and welfare.
I imagine there is another situation. Somebody ended up in a mental hospital in a violation of Scottish law. What his relatives or human rights activists can do in order to protect his rights?
Well, I think the protection of rights applies both to people who have offended, who have committed a crime, and also to other people. And there are certain checks and balances in the system to protect people's rights. If you're an offender, I had been arrested by the police, I had a major mental illness, I had schizophrenia, and I believed that cars in the street were doing something against me, and I went and smashed those cars up, and I was arrested. I'd be taken to a police station, and the first line of protection is that the police, if they believed that I was vulnerable in some way, I had a mental illness, is that they have to interview me in the company of an appropriate adult. And this is somebody who is there really as a kind of guardian of my rights while I'm being interviewed. That's over and above any legal representation that I would have. I would, if I didn't have my own legal representative, I could have a public defender appointed to act on my behalf. The whole ethos of managing people with mental health problems in the criminal justice system is to make sure that people get the treatment that they need. So very early on, I'd be assessed by a psychiatrist, and I could in fact be deflected away from the criminal justice system into the civil system and go straight to hospital. If the offence was more serious and it was thought that by the prosecutor that it needed to go to court, then there are mechanisms that would allow me to go to hospital for assessment prior to the court hearing. Or if I went to prison, if it wasn't picked up at that point, there are mechanisms for me to be transferred from prison into the health service. People with mental illness wouldn't get treated in the prison service. That's not to say there aren't people with mental illness who are in prison, but the main aim is that if you have a mental illness, regardless of the offence that you committed, if you need treatment, hospitals are the place for that treatment. If it was a very serious offence, you know, like a where I posed a high risk to other people, I would be sent to what's called a state hospital, which is a high security hospital. We have medium secure facilities too, but the state hospital, which is quite small, is a high security facility.
You just mentioned the different types of hospitals,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure our listeners are wondering what are the conditions in those hospitals. This major concern.
I've been involved in mental health in Scotland for quite a few decades, and when I first was involved, we still had large Victorian institutions that weren't the best place to provide to help people recover from their illnesses. As I'm sure everyone understands, institutions breed their own problems, and they don't necessarily promote individuals' rights. It's the rights of the institution tend to take precedence over the rights of individuals. But I'm glad to say that things have changed. It's not all perfect, and there's still some not very good services, but generally the services in Scotland are far more community focused now, and there are far fewer inpatient beds than there were, and those that are there tend to be in modern facilities. The state hospital, which is the place that people are often most concerned about, because any closed institution like that, the risks to the people who are there are probably greater. I used to work there. I worked there in the early 1980s, and it wasn't a good place then.
So you worked inside the system.
Yes, I worked in the system, and it was a bad place. It wasn't good. Not through particularly malevolent staff, but the practices there were poor. We'll give an example of that: the use of seclusion, which means locking somebody up in a room, mm-hmm. Was used far too often. There was limited opportunity for rehabilitative work, and the general attitudes to people were more treating them as offenders or victims rather than people who have a mental illness. And there wasn't a high level of sophistication of tying up people's behaviour to their mental illness, and value judgments were often made about people's behaviour. So it was a kind of punitive environment, not everywhere in the place, but there was a fairly strong theme of that. So changing that is hard. Changing those kind of attitudes is tough, but it can be done, and it has been done there. It's an institution that is transformed. The risks are always there of different levels of abuse, but I must say they've done a very good job in the state hospital compared to the days when I was involved with it.
If you can generalize how this system works, can you evaluate it? Does it work as fluently without any problems, or there are some stops, obstacles?
Inevitably, it's a complex system, and mental illnesses are not easily categorized into neat boxes. I suppose the test of any system is, does an individual who, with all their needs, all their difficulties they have, the challenges they faced, does the service adapt to meet those needs, and does it promote their independence? I think the services that I know of are better than they were at that, but there are still problems, there are still gaps in the services. For me, as I was saying earlier, the biggest development in the Scottish services, there are lots of practical things that are better. There are far more community services. There are early intervention services for people with psychotic illnesses, which are very important in reducing the impact of illnesses like schizophrenia. But for me, from a rights point of view, the biggest development were the inclusion of a set of principles in the Scottish mental health legislation. They've really given a kind of common language for all the different people who are involved in mental health: the doctors, the nurses, the social workers, the voluntary sector workers, the carers, the relatives. the most important people, of course, the patients, the service users themselves. These principles have given a common language that can be applied to decisions that are made about people's care, and that's been the biggest and best development in my time in involvement in mental health. These principles are around things like that whatever you do should be for the benefit of the person. Any care that's given should be in the least restrictive way. It's about people participating in decisions about themselves, and all that means, all the implications of that, of having information, because you're powerless if you don't have information. It's about participating in a meaningful way in decisions about your care, and that leads on to things like the use of advanced statements of when one is in judgment is not impaired, of writing out how you would like to be treated if your judgment does become impaired. These kind of developments have been very, very important.
Mm-hmm. James, if I can ask for a particular example in this way. For example, in Russia, we can read in the Urals, in Yekaterinburg, we can read sometimes reports, or our NGO receives some complaints from people who say that there are examples when a person is being put into a mental hospital by their relatives in order to get rid of this person, or in order to get hold of his or her property, a house, for example. Does it happen in Scotland, and how your institution deals with this issue?
Up until the new legislation that I was referring to earlier, it was possible for a relative to initiate the compulsory treatment of their relative. That was removed in the 2003 Act. Although saying that, it was very rare for it to happen before. Most of the applications were made by a specialist social worker who made the application to court then.
So then they're not involved in?
Now they have no powers in relation to that. They have certain rights in relation to their involvement in the process about receiving information, and they can act independently of the patient themselves in appealing against compulsory detention, but they can't initiate it themselves. There is other legislation in Scotland that covers that for people whose capacity is impaired. It's possible for people to apply to be a financial guardian, but that has to go through a court, and they have to be approved before they can make decisions about that person's property. The actual mental health legislation does have sections of it that relate to the protection of that person's property. So it would be, nothing is impossible, of course, but it would be very, very difficult for a relative to initiate the detention of somebody in hospital now in Scotland, if not impossible.
I'm sure the participants of the seminar we are going to take part in will be very much interested in this.
There are other layers of protection, of course, because if it became clear that if there was an issue of somebody's property being misused, somebody who was subject to compulsory powers, the fact that they're subject to those powers doesn't diminish their rights in any other way. It wouldn't allow their property, their personal belongings to be taken or abused in any way by a relative. You'd be in the same position as anyone else. So there are other protections there.
James, what is it that you like about your job? What is it that made you to devote your professional life to this to this area?
Gosh, that's a difficult question.
Sorry.
One ends up in a career for a variety of reasons, but there's one thing I think I thought very early on when I was very junior and was I couldn't understand why anyone should be treated any differently just because they had a mental health problem. Because what is a mental health problem? All of us will have some mental distress or difficulty through our life, whether you call it illness or whatever. But it always struck me that why should it make you any different? And I suppose I've held on to that throughout my career, particularly working in high security settings, where I have seen things I wished I hadn't seen, and I've seen people put in bad situations. So I suppose because of that, that led to me getting into the job that I've done for the past 14 years, which is about protecting, promoting the rights of people. There's a quote that I use sometimes, and it relates to going back to these principles again, which to me are the most important thing in the world, the small world of Scottish mental health that I live in. There's a quote from a psychiatrist, an Austrian psychiatrist called Adler, who said that it's easy to fight for one's principles, but it's much more difficult to live up to them. And that's been what has kept me going through seeing some pretty awful things as well, because I've been involved in investigations of situations that were very bad, where people got very bad care. But that's what's kept me going.
Mm. James, do you have any numbers of how many people have problems, mental problems?
Off the top of my head, I can't quote you numbers about specific Scottish numbers about the incidence of mental illness. In Scotland, in terms of compulsory powers, this is a population of about 5 million of Scotland. Of long-term compulsory powers, about just over 1,000 people a year are subject to long-term compulsory powers. And when I say long-term, that's for up to 6 months and can be repeated. Short-term orders it's about 3,000, and the medium-term ones are about 2,500. And that's tended to be fairly constant over the years, although it changed. There was one aspect of it that changed markedly when we had our new legislation, and that there was a big drop in emergency orders, which was a good thing. That was an intention, because that was probably the area that was most misused under the previous legislation. In terms of offenders, it's a much lower level than that of people who are subject to orders that come into the criminal justice system. It's a tiny amount. It's very important to remember that most people receive their care without recourse to mental health legislation. It's a very small proportion of people with mental health problems who require to be given treatment compulsorily.
Mm-hmm. I asked this question because recently I came across a report, somebody predicting that within maybe 10 or 20 years, the mental illness, depression, will be the major disability problem among the people. It's due to the contemporary stress because of the work, environment, all these issues. And I think it's the importance of this issue is growing. Even this relatively non-problematic institutions like Cambridge University, the issue of depression among students is very important, and mental health issues are very important.
I'm not a clinical expert on depression and the incidence of depression.
They're somehow related, are they?
I can say a little something about a related subject, which is about suicide and incidents of suicide. And in fact, I looked this up before I came away, because I'm doing some work on how health services in Scotland respond when one of their patients kills themselves. And I was looking at the figures, and Scotland actually has quite a high suicide rate in Western European terms. But I looked up the Russian rate. Now, these figures are hard to compare, because often they're collected in different ways. But I was amazed to see that the Russian rate was high, but it's three times as high as the rate in Scotland. I was really quite struck by that. And I was thinking, really, I'm not a clinical expert on this, but there are some similarities in Scottish and Russian culture, and I think probably alcohol consumption is one of them. It's a significant public health problem in Scotland, but the levels of drinking, and I understand that's an issue in Russia too. So depression, I guess, can be related to other things. From stress, it can be all of these things can be interlinked about general lifestyle and alcohol, illegal substances, drug misuse. All of these things can go together. However, in saying all of that, now, and I certainly don't know what the figures are for Russia, because its population demographics are probably very different to Scotland, which has an aging population. The big thing on the horizon for Scotland is dementia, that with an aging population, the numbers of people with dementia are going to rise by a very large percentage, and that has great implications for mental health services, who are the people who provide a lot of the dementia care, and that's probably more significant from where I'm from.
Dementia
is a condition that is often seen in old age, where people's cognition and cognitive powers and memory are impaired by progressive deterioration of their brain. Mm-hmm. And it's not just for older people, but it's predominantly seen in older people. Conditions like Alzheimer's disease, and that's a very significant issue for Scottish services.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, James, for this answers. Maybe I can ask you about your well, you spent one day in Ekaterinburg. Maybe it's better to ask this question after, just before you leave for Scotland. But maybe there is something which you were surprised already about Russia, Ekaterinburg, Russians, communication, I don't know, the weather. Something which you can share, or something you maybe didn't like, you liked, you just was amazed.
Well, the most important thing about anywhere is the people, and the people have been so friendly and have been very patient with a stupid person who can't speak Russian, and they've been very, very patient, and that's been great. Everyone has been helpful and nice and pleasant, and that's lovely. And I like the wide open spaces of Ekaterinburg. I live in Edinburgh, which is a very old city with quite sort of narrow streets, so it's nice to be in a wide open place. There's one thing I would say though, which is I wish I could see more original Russian wooden buildings in Ekaterinburg, because they're lovely, and don't knock any more of them down.
Well, I'm sure you will have a chance to see those buildings in the place where we're going for the seminar, and hopefully you will really like it and enjoy this experience. And I just wanted to remind that in our studio was James Macomb, originally trained as a mental health nurse, who prior to retiring at the end of the last year was Commissioner and Deputy Director of the Mental Welfare Commission for Scotland. Thank you very much for coming to our studio, James. And my name is Anton Burkov. I'm a member of the NGO Sutyazhnik, and I was running this program today. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.